Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. In today's episode, we speak with Tomás and Hannah, co-founders at startup MiFiel, based out of Mexico. They take us through their journey building MiFiel, why they use Bitcoin as the fundamental technology behind their service, which is a great success case in Mexico's promissory note or pagaré market. They allow their customers to securely sign and transfer digital contracts, and they take us through their journey on why this is relevant and important. We hope you enjoy. If you do, please remember to like or share, follow, comment. This all helps us greatly. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only.
Build with Bitcoin is a proud affiliate partner of River. I've personally used River for years and I highly recommend the product and the company. If you would like a seamless start to your Bitcoin-only financial services, use our exclusive link below, partner.river.com/buildwithbitcoin.
Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. I'm co-host Israel Munoz, along with co-host Lynn. Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Tomás and Hannah, co-founders at MiFiel. Tomás, Hannah, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Israel.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. And, you know, we're excited to get into this conversation, which is very different and probably unheard of use case in the Bitcoin space. So, we'll get into what you guys are working on at MiFiel. And what you're doing as far as signing and securing digital contracts in Mexico. But before we get into MiFiel, we'd like to start with a little more about both of your backgrounds, Tomás and Hannah. So maybe both from the perspective of, you know, how you got into Bitcoin and what that kind of represents for you individually, as well as how MiFiel, you know, kind of the backstory and how it started.
All right. Yeah. You want to start, Hannah, or because I started in Bitcoin first, so maybe I can start
exactly
from my journey. Okay.
That's what
I my first introduction with Bitcoin was back in 2011. It was June or July 2011, just after the crash, one of the first crashes of Mt. Gox, where it went to almost cents. And I found that I'm a mechatronics engineer. That's what I have my degree on. And I was working on some electronic stuff and I was in an electronics forum, checking a thread about something that had nothing to do with Bitcoin. But one of the posters, their signature had the link to something related to Bitcoin. So I clicked on that because I was curious. And then it kind of changed my life because I got very into understanding that. So I downloaded my first wallet. It was Bitcoin QP. I don't even know if it exists still, but I bought some Bitcoin. It was super difficult to buy. I have to have my brother that lives in New York to put cash in an envelope and send it to some dude in Berkeley. My brother was like, "Are you sure you want me to leave?" And I was like, yeah, just do it. I'll give you the dollars when I see you. And then the Bitcoin did arrive in my wallet. And back then they were like $1.5 per Bitcoin, something ridiculous. So I played with them and then I 6x my money or something like that. And I said, okay, this is very good. And I sold everything and kind of forgot about it. One of the biggest regrets in my life. And I started getting ready to do a master's in the US. And this is important because that's where I meet Hannah. No? So I go to the US to do my master's and I meet Hannah there. And it's a master's Carnegie Mellon University. We were doing a master's in product development. So I meet her and I start like a startup club in our group of like advancing ideas. I always had this entrepreneurial spirit and Hannah joined the group and then we were ideating things. And after the master's, I got again into Bitcoin. I had time and that was 2013, just when Bitcoin was reaching $60-$70. And so there, Hannah got a job in New York. We were dating back then. So I followed her to New York looking for a job. And meanwhile, she and I were coding what later became Bolavit. Our first startup was this Bitcoin exchange in Mexico. I would do the back end and she would do the front end when she would come back from work. She already had a job at a design agency. And that's where Hannah got involved in Bitcoin. And we built this like first version of Bolavit from a apartment in New York. I can let Hannah take over.
And what year are we talking about there, by the way?
So this was 2013.
Yeah.
13.
Summer 2013, we were working on this platform.
So yeah, I think I got introduced to Bitcoin through Tomas, I think maybe late 2012. And he finally convinced me to buy my first Bitcoins in early 2013. And I have to admit, at the time, I kind of did it blindly. I didn't understand what all the interest in Bitcoin was about. And I really only started, it hit me when we built that first prototype that Tomas mentioned. And this was a prototype that allowed people to deposit Bitcoins to our service, which was basically just a website. And we would convert that to dollars. So they would be able to hold like a dollar balance. And then if they wanted to withdraw it back in Bitcoins, we'd be able to send them back the Bitcoins. And Tomas posted this on Reddit, in an Argentinian Reddit forum, right? Like a Bitcoin Reddit forum. And it just like took off overnight. And I think that's when it really kind of like hit me, because having grown up in the US for the most part and with the, you know, the hegemony of the dollar and all that good stuff, like you never really appreciate what it means to like hold a dollar balance. So when people, just complete strangers that had no idea about us, started depositing money in our very nascent service, that's when it hit me that, wow, this is real, and this is a great monetary innovation that has a lot of value for people outside of the US. So that's when I kind of started reading a little bit more. Like I delved into the white paper. I watched a couple of videos by Antonopoulos. There wasn't a lot of materials back then. But I think, I don't think I understood the full extent of the technological innovation at the time. And I still feel like I don't now, but I don't understand the full extent of it, but I had this gut feeling at the time, and I still do now, that this solution to decentralized trust was going to be something big. It was a paradigm shift. And I think that's something that I believe to this day. And that's what kind of got us motivated to start developing in the Bitcoin space and building infrastructure around there.
I'm going to jump in here too, because even though the conversation today is really about Mifiel, an admission, I know Tomas and Hannah, I met you guys in like 2014 when you were launching Volibit, and you were part of the Boost Accelerator. And I had my venture fund, Meet Ventures, and I was so excited to meet, I think you were the first startup in Mexico that was dealing in the Bitcoin space. And so we lost touch over the years, and I'm so excited that we get to have this conversation today just to talk about your journey as a startup, going from this very first Bitcoin-only exchange and then to what you're doing now. So maybe you can kind of fast forward the progress of Volibit and how you came to start Mifiel.
Yeah, so just to give a quick kind of overview of what happened with Volibit and how we arrived at Mifiel, it wasn't very linear, but with that prototype that we built, we got into an accelerator called Boost VC, which is led by Adam Draper. He actually deposited money in our little prototype. And that's kind of how we got into the space. And in the beginning, we also wanted to develop around the use case of remittance, having Tomas being from Mexico and being familiar with the use case. But we both come from a product development background and a design thinking background. So something that we did early on with Volibit was we went out and did some ethnographic research, and we talked to real immigrants that use Western Union and all that good stuff. So we went out and did this research and kind of quickly early on figured out that, you know, this remittance use case, while it is very attractive, wasn't a big enough pain point for these immigrants to switch over to a new solution. So that's when we made the shift kind of last minute before our demo day and decided to build Volibit, which was the first kind of like on-ramp, off-ramp to Bitcoin in Mexico. And while we continued to work on Volibit, we realized a couple of years into it that there wasn't really a great product market fit between what we envisioned to be like a Bitcoin service in Mexico and what the market wanted, which was more of a like an altcoin trading platform, which we didn't really align with our philosophy. So that's when we started looking into different problems that we were seeing while we were working on Volibit. And as a financial company, we had this pain point where regulators were requiring us to get certain legal documentation signed from our customers And we realized that there wasn't a fast and easy way and a secure way to get those documents signed electronically. And as a completely online company, we didn't want to add the friction having to sign physical documents and send them over and everything. So that's when we kind of started looking into the electronic signature space. Why was DocuSign not being used? You know, we were both very familiar with DocuSign, HelloSign, EchoSign, everything, and realized that it just didn't work within the legal framework of Mexico. And that's when we started developing MiFiat, which started out as a basically as a way to make electronic signing easy and secure in Mexico.
Just to kind of round off that transition, Hannah and Tomas, I mean, the pivot, which of course is now the focus, this, you know, electronic signature component, was that because you saw MiFiat immediately having just a larger market to address, more demand? It was just a more attractive business case? Or can you get into exactly the, you know, the decision point between winding down Volavit and just fully pivoting to a totally different use case?
Yeah, so I mean, here it aligns with bear markets and bull markets, right? So 2014, the bear market had just happened in 2013 before Mt. Gox imploded and it went down. And so we launched in 2014 as that was crashing down and exploding, February or March 2014. So the market was very, well, there was no market. It was dead, right? So for 2014, dead. 2015, dead. 2016, dead. And so we had the investment and we have a burn rate. And we're like, okay, we need to figure out something because this is not, we didn't know what was going to happen. Right now we know that every 4 years you make money like a bandit and then you have to save enough for the next 4 years, right? So we launched MiFiat in 2016, trying to fix this internal problem that we had. And we put it out and it started being used. So 2016, we got some traction. 2017, we got some traction. But in 2017, you have the other bull run of Bitcoin. And then Volavit started making good money. And then we're like, okay, maybe we should keep both. Volavit will just take the bull markets to make money. And then MiFiat will be just like a normal SaaS company it's shielded from these market cycles that can completely destroy you if you don't know what you're doing. That's why we have both. But eventually, MiFiat became way more interesting and was growing faster, and we could measure and project revenues and all this good stuff that you're supposed to do when you're a normal company. And we decided, also the regulatory environment in Mexico started changing a lot. So we were like, we're going to have to give one up. And everybody, so we have another partner. We decided we were going to give all of it up and we're going to go full on MiFiat.
Yeah, jump into exactly what MiFiat is doing now and why we're talking today, because we were actually, this got brought to our attention. We had a recent conversation with Adolfo Contreras from Blockstream. And so he was giving MiFiat as his case study of one of the success stories about using Liquid. And we got to talking and it's like, oh my gosh, I know Tomas and Hannah. And so I'm so happy that we were able to connect again. And I was noticing Blockstream did a major VC raise yesterday and they actually singled you out as one of the success cases. So let's fast forward through Volabit and whatever. And what are you doing today with Liquid, and how has, you have a massive success right now with MiFiat.
Yeah. So, so we started out as an electronic signature platform with like this mission of allowing any legal documents to be signed electronically. Right. But then we quickly ran into this dilemma or this problem of there are certain documents that can't just be signed electronically. And for me as an American, I that was a foreign concept to me. Like, why couldn't these documents be signed electronically? But we realized that there are certain documents that function that are basically bearer assets or negotiable instruments, like promissory notes, that form a very fundamental part of the financial system and the legal systems in Mexico. And they rely on this property of being unique, the one single original document. And so when we saw that and we realized that these documents couldn't just be signed electronically, we thought, okay, this sounds a little bit familiar, right? It's like a digital property that needs to be given the property of uniqueness. Where can we find that? And we just kind of did the math, put the two and two together, and decided this might actually be one of those few use cases where blockchain and digital assets, unique digital assets, could shine and could actually deliver value. And a little bit of context on this, like I think Tomas says this very frequently on his interviews and in other podcasts and whatnot, but we're really, really firm believers in that blockchain can solve a few problems very well and is not the solution to the vast majority of the problems that we see people applying blockchains to today. So we're very conservative in the sense of like applying Bitcoin, applying blockchain, applying cryptography to different solutions in our product. So we obviously thought this through like very carefully, made sure that we weren't just like tacking on a technology that we love onto a problem that we're seeing. And lo and behold, it did end up being a solution to the problem and a solution for the market. But in the beginning, we didn't see a lot of adoption for this product because not because of any like product flaws or any features lacking per se, but rather because the market just didn't have the pain point that was big enough to adopt this very new and very novel solution. So that's where kind of we went into this period of hibernation with the solution that that we built. And there was practically like no adoption or very little adoption between like 2018 when we first developed it and like 2022 or 23, correct me if I'm wrong. 2021. Yeah. So we started getting a few kind of early adopters, financial companies that were very tech savvy and forward looking, adopting the solution. And that kind of continued until it really like took off in 2023, I believe, when there was a massive non-banking financial services crisis in Mexico. And we can go into a little bit more detail with that context. But basically, this became the catalyst for massive adoption in this product. And now we have, what, like $1.4 billion that of promissory notes that have been issued on our platform. So, yeah, we're really excited to see this like transition. But it was a very sudden shift and it required us kind of just kind of building it out and waiting it out until the right moment happened for this to take off.
And Hannah or Tomas, can you, I mean, Hannah, you probably are like myself, I mean, originally US and now in Mexico, and over the years, I have come to appreciate the importance of the promissory note in all financial transactions in the region, which was something that was foreign to me when I first arrived. Can you talk a little bit about what the role is of a promissory note in Mexico and LATAM and just kind of broadly?
Yeah, I'll answer that one. So courts in Mexico and Latin America, they're not fast as in the US. They're very slow. And so in Mexico, when you're suing someone for not paying you back, you have two options, which is a normal court proceeding, which can take years. And then you have something we call executive courts, which are the ones you go when the debtor signed a promissory note. And the main difference is that when you have a promissory note signed by, for example, Israel, if he owes me money and he's refusing to pay, I take that promissory note to a judge. And the first thing the judge will do is assume that the debt exists and will issue an embargo on Israel's properties or assets. Usually just that makes the debtor feel, okay, I should pay, no, because I'm going to get an embargo if I don't, or like a seizure of assets. So that's why every single loan in Mexico and most of Latin America is always backed by the promissory note, because that way the lender knows if he or she defaults, I can just present the promissory note, and just the threat of having things seized will bring them to the negotiation to see how they can pay, no? Unlike if we only had a contract and then I sue you on a contract that take 2 years and there's no preemptive seizing of assets. So then every financial company has people sign this. And then what changed, or what Hannah was alluding to, is so a non-banking financial institution, they for example, let's say leasing, they lease industrial machinery. So they get a promissory note for each piece of machinery they lease. And then they need more money because they're not banks. So they need to find funding sources. And so they might find banks that will fund them or hedge funds that will fund them. And before, it was enough for the financial company to sign a promissory note that says, bank, I owe you 200 million pesos, and then they get 200 million. But then we had the four biggest non-banking financial institutions blow up one after the other. That started in 2020 or a little bit earlier. And then by 2022, they were all broke, all of these four big companies. So then all the funding ceased, and no one wanted to lend to these people or to these companies unless they could provide collateral. And in a smaller, if it's a small financial company, maybe the owner has a ranch and some houses that he can post as collateral. But usually the main collateral a financial company has is its portfolio of debt. So, oh, I have 70 million pesos worth of debt. I can pledge that to you, and then you lend me on that. That process of pledging requires you signing over the promissory notes to the lender and physically giving it to them. And so that is where things start to break down when you're doing it in paper, because maybe you're lending in the north of Mexico, in Chihuahua, and the lender is in Mexico City. And so then you have to transport every single one of those papers. You have to send them over to Mexico City. They have to be warehoused in Iron Mountain, for example, or one of these custodians. And then the lender, when the debt is repaid, and they have to send it back to Chihuahua so you can give it back to the person that asked for the loan. And that in paper doesn't work. So it was, now there is no funding, and you have either, you pledge me your loan, your debt, or I don't give you anything. And that's what triggered this use case that you alluded to with Luxury.
And just to kind of clarify, so these pieces of paper aren't really paper. Going back to what Hannah said, they're bearer instruments. So they're like a cash. They're like a cash equivalent because they represent the ability to collect a debt, correct?
Yes. So they're not exactly bearer. We call them negotiable instruments, but they act, you go with that paper, and that paper, you get a paper that says, oh, this is worth 100 million pesos. Well, that would be a lot. A million pesos. You know that you can collect a million pesos with that.
It's considered hard asset. That's a solid collateral for these institutions, right? As you were alluding to, promissory notes, there's a clear regulatory and judicial environment and precedent for them in Mexico. They've existed for a very long time, but it sounds like it was this set of failures that you mentioned, Tomas, that kind of led to the market in Mexico to realize, hey, okay, we need to have hard assets as collaterals in order to, you know, loan or work with you. And then is that the moment that basically lots of these institutions kind of see themselves up against the wall between needing to scale and still using paper-backed, you know, hard assets, let's say, and needing to make that leap? Or what was the technological push?
I think maybe before jumping into that, we could explain a little bit more clearly the stakeholders that are involved, because Tomas mentioned the financial companies that are originating the loans, and then there's also the funders. But in the middle, there's two or three very important players, depending on the structure. And those are the master servicers, who are basically kind of supervising the whole process to make sure that everything is going smoothly, that basically protecting the interests of the funders. And there's also the fiduciary banks that are, well, acting as fiduciaries and providing the service of a trust. So in this context, I think one of the biggest challenges that we face, as you're alluding to, is convincing the stakeholders to get on board, right? Because it's not just the funders and the financial companies. If it were that simple, I think it would have been a much smoother process. But we face this huge barrier of like going up against these big institutions, lenders, fiduciaries, et cetera, that were for the most part not technologically forward and that were definitely not looking into using the blockchain or Bitcoin-based solutions for their problems. But they had this huge, huge need of needing to set up these structures and having them work, because there was no other way to kind of protect the funders who had this huge appetite for lending in Mexico, but did not want to be exposed to all the risk. And on the other hand, there's the financial companies that obviously needed the funding, but it really was, I think, a context where if it wasn't for there being such a huge need, nobody would have adopted the solution, because I would say a solid percentage of our client base right now probably doesn't really fully understand what they signed up for and doesn't really know that it's being run on Liquid or blockchain, or all of this layer has kind of been like extrapolated, and we've made it very user-friendly so that what they see is a trustworthy platform where they can get transparency and where they can get clarity regarding where the assets are and who has them and all that good stuff. So I think a couple of things that were very important there was like the big need that existed to make this work, which obviously with physical documents would have been not viable. And then on the other hand, this, I guess us not forcing blockchain on them and trying to make it as easy as possible and make the decision as straightforward as possible for all these big actors that were understandably a little bit hesitant about using new technology.
I want to add something there. It started, it was a very specific project where it was a fintech in Mexico, a non-fintech that had raised a lot of money. And they suddenly they can't get any more money. And so, but their whole project was digital, their fintech, that was their whole value prop. So they approached their funding bank, which it's one of the biggest investment banks in the US and in the world. And they said, hey, can we do it digitally? And that bank, that American bank, was the one that was the first one that said, okay, let's look into this. And that influenced some things of why we use Liquid and things like that. But once that bank did it, other fintech companies that were being funded by the same bank approached that same bank. And then that's how the ball started rolling until it started bleeding into non-fintech companies that were looking at these fintech companies having a very, they were getting funding and they were not. And they're like, why are they getting funding and we're not? And that's what, oh, they're using this digital pagaret and that promissory notes. And that's how it kind of started. If that the project,
the domino effect.
It was a domino effect, 2021. Mexico takes time. People don't want to adopt new technology. They will postpone it until it's completely necessary. So that the stuff that we're seeing right now, 2024, it started in that little domino in 2021 that like flipped, and now it's happening here.
Well, tell us a little bit about who is your customer. So what is the profile of someone who uses this service?
Yeah, sure. So our customers, the ones that actually pay us for using the service, are the financial companies. They initially, a lot of them started out just using us for the electronic signature piece. Because as Tomas mentioned, a lot of these companies are digitally native. They're born digital, so they want to offer 100% online services. So that's how they got started. And then they kind of ran into this problem. And we worked in a very collaborative way with them. We, as I mentioned before, we have this background in product development, design thinking. So we were really curious to understand their pain points. And in a lot of ways, we kind of co-designed the solution with our customers, which is something that really is near to our heart. As for the other stakeholders that are involved, they're more, I would say, users of the platform than customers. But we are in the process of developing more comprehensive solutions for structured finance that would involve bringing more of them on as.
And, you know, I want to maybe go back to something you mentioned a little earlier, Hannah. You mentioned your customers are looking for security and transparency, right? And as far as a provider that allows them to digitally sign these and secure these contracts. Lots of people might hear that and think, hold on, Bitcoin technology, that, you know, maybe that doesn't make sense to me. Which is, you know, I think the irony and curiosity here of, you know, your choice from just a technology and regulatory standpoint, why do you work with Bitcoin's Liquid Network in this case, as opposed to, you know, any other blockchains that people throw around and, you know, like to talk about being better solutions? I mean, can you expand on that point a little bit? Because you're dealing with, you know, customers who you again mentioned that what they're looking for is peace of mind, security, transparency, working with the law.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, like personally speaking, security is one of the core values and strengths of Bitcoin. So we can't really find any more secure and stable technology to base our solution on. But at the same time, we couldn't put it directly on the main chain because a lot of these transactions are, well, our customers are cost sensitive and each transaction needs to have a lower transaction costs. So the cost was an important factor there when we decided to switch to Liquid. And also there's the aspect of like the timeliness. They have to be transactions that occur quickly enough. And there also we ran into some barriers with Bitcoin. But in an ideal case scenario, if Bitcoin were fast enough and cheap enough, I think we would have put it directly on Bitcoin, honestly. But Liquid really, like, it's been such a, just on a side note, such a pleasure to work with Blockstream because they really helped us kind of like shape our product as well. They're always a good sounding board, and that's why we have a really good relationship with Adolfo. And for us, it was a no-brainer to use and actually switch to Liquid because previous to that, we were using a different protocol on the Litecoin blockchain. And it was a no-brainer for us because Liquid strikes that balance perfectly and leverages the stability and security of the Bitcoin as blockchain as a base layer while offering scalability and speed and cost effectiveness. And so for us, it wasn't really a tough choice for me when it came to deciding on Liquid. And also, I think Tomas can speak to more to this point, but there was a regulatory layer where we didn't want to use the blockchain of any assets that could be, any blockchain that could potentially in the future be considered securities. So that, considering that we were dealing with a lot of investment banks, and large institutions in general, that was a risk that we were not willing to take. So in general, I think we didn't really have to debate much internally until we decided to use Liquid.
Yeah, just to add to that point, the investment bank that I made reference to that was the first one to get into this, when we were, because we switched from Litecoin to Liquid as we were working with them, and their main concern was we cannot build on a chain in which in the future the native token is considered a security. That is going to make it will not make this viable, and we don't want to risk that. And so then what are you left with? The only one that the regulators in the US have said this is not an asset is Bitcoin. So everything else, even if we were interested in using something else, which we were not, but even if we were, we couldn't have used it, because then that bank would have said, I cannot touch this. And the other big investment bank that also joined later, they also said the same thing. So it was like, okay, good thing, because we're not using any of that. We're using Bitcoin in the Liquid chain.
I want to just kind of expand on this concept and kind of zoom out a little bit, because we've been talking about promissory notes in Mexico, which may seem like a very narrow piece of the financial puzzle globally. But the way I look at it is you're really dealing with a opportunity that exists globally and in a much larger scale. I mean, you're really talking about real world assets in a tokenized way and improving liquidity, providing liquidity to players in the global financial system that may have had difficulty getting it before. So can you talk a little bit broader about the problem you're solving with this particular solution and how you might see it expand beyond the use case, which is, I mean, it's a narrow use case, but it's a big opportunity because you have $1.5 billion already that you've secured in this way. But I think the opportunity is massive in terms of what the potential is for what you've kind of uncovered.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been looking into what blockchain is good for a very long time. There's podcasts where we talk about blockchain identity and how blockchain for identity doesn't work, blockchain for this doesn't work, for supply chains, blah, blah, blah. So what we found out with the promissory note is that you have in the end, a promissory note is just a promise to pay. It's not it's not something real like a car or a house or a bar of gold, in which we don't think blockchain would work, because what happens if they come out of sync, and what if the gold bar doesn't move with the blockchain? And in a promissory note, it's just a promise. It's nothing tangible. There's nothing tangible that anchors it to the real world. That's why we think it works very well, because you're moving a promise around, and then you tokenize that, and then the promise moves around. And in the end, you just have to prove that the promise was promised to you, and that's it. And there are many cases where that matters, mainly not so much in countries that do civil law, the common law, which is like the UK-based system. But in countries that are based more on the French model of civil law, and you have international commerce, for example, the letter of Leyden, I think it's called letters of credit, that you don't have a central repository where you can go and check like a stock, where you have the stock market and they're there. You have this promise. In the end, they're all promises that there's not a single sort of truth. And that's why they have to be a piece of paper. And you hear these stories where the paper has to go with the ship. And then when the ship arrives to port, they give all the stack of papers to the personnel of the receiving port so they can forward it to the receiving bank. And so it's usually what we've been working with Adolfo a lot is, where does it make sense? Where does this kind of make sense? And it's an intangible promise where there's not a central repository to look at. So a stock of a company is an intangible promise, right? Especially maybe it's a distributed company that has no, like Binance, right? They don't have an office, they don't have assets, they have a website, no? So, but stocks have a central place where you trade them, and regulators are not going to give that up. But there are many assets like that that don't have a central repository, and then you need a way to be able to track the ownership of these things. And that's where we're focusing.
And, you know, I'm glad you bring up those points, Tomas, because it's actually very, I think, a very important lesson or overview on where, you know, Bitcoin blockchain technology actually makes sense and where it doesn't, right? And I think that there is a big education gap or misunderstanding there as well, because as you alluded to, you know, you often hear, oh, blockchain for this, that, and it's going to solve everything. Of course, it's not. But just to maybe summarize some of the points you just mentioned, I mean, you're talking about digitally native securing data where we need to avoid a double spend and where there's an absence of some sort of central mechanism or authority that can do that. I mean, and there's many cases where that works perfectly, right? And you know, I think centralized intermediaries can be, you know, a benefit to certain societies and economies. But to your point, we don't have that luxury in all markets, and there's still lots of inefficiencies out there. So all that to say, where do you see, I mean, MIFIED for you guys, you know, Hannah and Tomas, are there any other particular demographics or use cases inside or outside of Mexico that you're already looking into?
Yeah, I think, well, there's some documents that are very similar in how they're used and how they function legally in Mexico that we can extend to. So those would be like the, what Tomas mentioned, like the equivalents of bills of lading. Or in Mexico,
letters of credit.
Letters of credit. We also have what I call certificates of deposit, which is also an interesting use case aside from this. But there's a lot of documents that have like similar characteristics that we're currently looking into to see if that makes sense. And of course, we can also look for other markets where there is a similar infrastructure and the financial system works in a similar way for us to just naturally extend these services. Aside from that, I think we're also just really genuinely interested in the use case of structured finance. It's just one of those things that I think for most people, if you hear structured finance, a product for structured finance, it would put them to sleep. But it's the kind of thing that our team, like Tomas and I and our co-founder, Genaro, we love to kind of chew on, no? As they say in Mexico, like masticar, because it's just one of those like very complex processes, complex problems involving a lot of people. So, and a lot of moving parts and a lot of complex processes. So we're really excited to kind of keep solving that problem in a better way, whether it be with or without applications of Bitcoin technology. And, just to mention there, I think we didn't mention this before, but in MIFIED, we take a lot of inspiration from Bitcoin where we don't use Bitcoin per se or Bitcoin tech, but we take a lot of the cryptography that is really magical, that is behind Bitcoin, and we try to apply a similar mechanism to what we do at MIFIED. So we have, for example, a product that we really love, where it's end-to-end encryption of all documents that people sign on our platform. And this is especially useful for regulated institutions like banks that cannot share their documents with third parties and third party providers. So we've been able to build these interesting solutions that have been inspired by our knowledge of cryptography and a lot of that coming from our knowledge of Bitcoin, to be able to provide like novel solutions for the market. So I think that's kind of like the direction that we want to keep expanding on, while integrating Bitcoin tech whenever it is relevant and whenever it can deliver real utility.
So just to add on that, the lending market in Mexico is the 13th or 12th biggest economy in the world. So we only have 1.5 billion. There's still a lot of debt that is not issued in our system. So we have that. And then we have all these other use cases that Hannah mentioned. And then the structured finance that we're doing in Mexico, usually Latin America replicates what is done in Mexico due to the like sophistication that they see in the Mexico City financial markets. So we are moving into, we haven't announced it yet, and there's still a little lag, but we're going to start moving into these other countries in Latin America to replicate what we've been doing here, in Mexico, in those markets.
And can you talk a little bit about the profile of the, I saw on your website, it's like you have Volkswagen, you have retail, you have, manufacturers. So are the majority of your clients or the users of the system, are they companies or do you have a lot of individual users too? Maybe speak a little bit about the portfolio of promissory notes.
So I would say it's 80% of our volume comes from financial companies. So like the Volkswagen, you saw Volkswagen Financial, it's a financial company, and then you have their big names the Santander Bank and this other brand that you might recognize. But then we have other companies that are not involved in promissory notes per se. They just use our signing product and also the encrypted product that Hannah was mentioning. So there we have like Jabil, which is this big, like a Foxconn competitor. Then we have Driscoll's, the little strawberries that you get in Safeway. So there are the strawberries that you get from Mexico. They originated in a contract that was signed in Mifiel with the owners of the greenhouses that grow them, right? So you will see some brands that you recognize in the US, but it's mainly financial companies. However, there are companies that are not financial companies that also sign pagares because they give credit to their customers. So there is this like Komatsu, which is kind of a Caterpillar of Japan. They are in Mexico and they make their customers sign promissory notes in case they don't pay the credit that they gave them, right? So it's not only financial companies, it can also be product companies that have to extend credit to their customers. And regarding, yes, we have these bigger companies, and then we have a bunch of smaller little law firms and little accounting firms that use us. But those, even though there might be a big number, they represent a small amount of our revenue. And we have it because we want everybody to have access to this. So you can just sign up and pay with a credit card and use the platform. So we hit. Also in Mexico, you can't be very picky of, no, I'm going to go mid-market or open. Like, you can't do that because the market's not big enough.
Whoever comes to you.
You know, it's super interesting what you are both mentioning, and, you know, kind of makes me wonder is there any competitor or, you know, kind of second best solution to what you're doing at Mifiel specifically in Mexico, Tomás and Hannah?
Yeah. So our big competitor is DocuSign. They are the ones they're publicly traded. They have thousands of employees. They came into Mexico. But they don't have the promissory note solution. So they are that part. They can't compete with us. There are other platforms that have done promissory notes, but their solutions, and this is important. It hasn't come up, but when we're talking with investment bank, they were like, okay, we are an investment bank of, I don't know, 7,000 people or 10,000 people. You have 27 people in your company. If you guys disappear tomorrow, that means we lose our hundreds of millions of debt that we have here with you. And that the interesting part with Liquid is that we do a multi-sig. So the custody is distributed between the main servicer, the backup servicer, and us. if we disappear, the other two can use the keys to keep operating this. There are other companies in Mexico that offer a service, but they don't have this. So if the company disappears or they go bust or something, the promissory notes go down with them. If the system is shut down, bye-bye promissory notes. Our promissory notes don't depend on MIFIL existing.
Which is a critical point, and I'm glad you bring that up, Tomás, because I guess that kind of brings us back to, you know, circles us back to Bitcoin, right? That you precisely what it's solving for in part is no single point of failure, right? In an immutable database. I think that's probably an overlooked but massively important, you know, aspect to the technology that you're using in this case.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, it goes in line with what I mentioned earlier about everything that we do is kind of informed. A lot of it is informed by how Bitcoin is built and the philosophy with which Bitcoin was built. So I think the distributed custodial model and this model that we built has been really essential, because with the volatility of a startup, and it's just a lot of risk for these large institutions, and it's given them a lot of peace of mind to be able to know that, yes, we are facilitating these processes and we're that layer that's making everything friendly, but we don't need to exist. All of this can just float freely in just with cryptography, with the keys and everything that just like this is built on. It doesn't depend on us. And I think that's really important.
I'd love to drill down a little bit more into MIFIL as a company. You mentioned 27 employees, which sounds like a small number to be dealing with that volume, $1.5 billion of you know, assets. And also just the, as we started the conversation with talking about how long you've been in the business, can you give us a little insight as to how your team members, are they distributed? Do you have offices? And how do you two share responsibilities? And how have you weathered the different ups and downs over the, you know, over the history of the company, which you shared with us?
Yeah, so we are a fully distributed team. We're completely remote. I think it's one of the main kind of selling points for the people that join us. We're three founders, actually. Renato's not with us today, but our CTO is also, we're all based in the same city, but we all work from each of our individual homes. And the way that we distribute our responsibilities. I think in the early days, as with a lot of different startups, we were overlapping too much on a lot of responsibilities, and that caused unnecessary friction. But as time went on, we just kind of each fell into each of our own niches. So Renato takes care of everything that is, you know, the technical base of the product. And that's, I can't emphasize enough the importance of that part. And I really appreciate him for being there. And I take care of the product and marketing and all kind of the more creative side of the company. And Tomás is the one that kind of does everything else in on top of leading the sales team and the operations area. So yeah, now we're trying to be more conscious about not stepping on each other's toes, and that has worked well for the most part. And we are a pretty small team, but I think something that we really value as a core value of the company is, well, prioritizing wealth to begin with, but also building things that matter. So we try to do a lot of user research. We try to understand the pain points intimately before we start building anything, so that we're not wasting time on building things that are not necessary or that might just add clutter to our product. So we try to be really, really focused and streamlined in that sense. And that has helped us maintain a more lean operation, a smaller team, while delivering value for our customers.
Maybe just going off of that, any advice, I guess, or comments? I mean, you've both been working in Bitcoin startup space. You know, you have a 10-year or 11-year, to be exact, from what I heard, you know, since the 2013, let's just use that. It's been a long journey, and you've pivoted more than once. I guess any lessons or you'd take away from that, anything you would have done differently, or that you now in hindsight just even more so appreciate that you stuck with, for example, I guess what are some of the takeaways from,
I'll start with this one, Anna, and then you can compliment. Adam Draper from Boost, he has this saying that when you're a Bitcoin company, you have to be a cockroach, that you have to be unkillable, right? And I mean, it's very lofty, but then when you analyze what does being a cockroach mean, so it means even if there's no funding, you need to survive. And we went through the fintech bust. Well, actually, everything bust, right? In 2021, everything bust. And we saw other companies that had raised money and that were being pressured to the bigger round and bigger round. We raised money, but it was a small round. And right now, we don't need money. We're profitable. And in fact, we have a very nice treasury, like a treasure, a war chest. So we're fine. We're in a good position now. And this company is going to be here for a while. But if you build or if you hire too much and then you don't get the cycles well, and then in Bitcoin, everything is very, nothing is written. Everything is very, it's always moving. You might not make it to the finish line. So it's try to do as much as you can, spending the little or the least that you can. Don't try to go there. Oh, I'm going to get this funding and this funding. Bitcoin is full of those companies that raise these eye-popping rounds, and then they only exist in 3 years because they didn't figure out what to do with that. No, like you can see all these names and every yeah, I make fun of that with the team. That's like, these guys are going to be dead in 2 years. No, when we see the rounds that they raise. And so, when you're in Bitcoin, you have to be low time preference. You have to think very in the future. You have to be self-reliant. You have to assume that it's going to be the worst. You have to plan for the worst. And when you start thinking like that, what we would do different is probably we wouldn't raise any money. We would just bootstrap and then do it again, but without the money. I mean, we had to back then. If we could do it again, like we sell Mifiel or something, we start again, we would bootstrap. And now we know how to run a lean company and how to read the number that you need to not die fast.
I love that. It's like Hannah, you've been talking about how a lot of what you offer is kind of built on the Bitcoin ethos or protocol. And it feels like the company itself is also very much of the Bitcoin ethos with the low time preference and longer time horizons and just being very thoughtful about how you spend your time and the investment that you have, which, you know, Israel and I, as we've been on this journey with the podcast and talked to a number of different Bitcoin companies, it does feel that that is one of the common threads. And I think it's a whole shift. Like when I first met you and there is Boost Accelerator, and that was very heady days in San Francisco in the tech early stage system. And, you know, the thought was you raise as much as you can and you move as fast as you can and you don't care about profitability. But that, to your point, Tomas, it's like a lot of those companies don't exist and the ones who are slower and steady. So I hope we see this shift in overall in starting companies where we return to a goal of profitability as early as you can and really being more thoughtful about the growth.
Yeah. And just to add to what Tomas mentioned, I think in line with being thoughtful about growth and focusing on profitability, I think it's really important for people in the Bitcoin space to try to solve real problems. And I think sometimes we've fallen into this trap as well, where we hear remittance and we hear, you know, these buzzwords and we think, well, we got to go solve problem. But I think a lot of times we realized that we were trying to force the technology into problems instead of looking at the real problems that exist, like and taking stock of what Bitcoin can offer or what it can offer, and then applying the technology when it makes sense to deliver real benefit and real value. And I think that's something that we kind of learned the hard way, but an important lesson that we learned, like problem first, not technology first. And I think it's one of the things that Tomas repeats the most often to other entrepreneurs. And I think more from a product perspective, because I'm a product person, I think it's kind of important to not force Bitcoin on people. I think a lot of times Bitcoin can solve a real problem, or blockchain or Liquid or all these other great technologies can solve real problems. But if we require the users to deal directly with the technology or be very close to it, then it could be very intimidating. It could be very prone to failure, errors, etc. So I think it's important to kind of, as product designers, it's important to make that, you know, layer of user friendliness that allows Bitcoin to become an accessible technology for more people and not just for the technological elite or for the elite in general, right? Because it has such great potential that it could deliver in this world. But if we don't make it accessible, then it's not going to be used. So yeah. I think that's another important thing that we learn.
It's so true. And I know the parallels are often drawn between the start of the internet and Bitcoin. And I think not enough people look at Bitcoin as a technology. But, you know, to date, so many of the Bitcoin companies are really replications of traditional financial companies like on-ramps, off-ramps, how you buy or a wallet or whatever. But as you've evolved, you've really found a whole new use case for how this technology can provide liquidity and security in structured finance. And I think, it's hard to think of a whole new use case for it. But once you study the technology enough, then it's like, oh, my gosh, this could fit where it hasn't ever been able to do that before. Like, micropayments is one area that I think has enormous growth that people aren't really thinking as much about. But what that the doors that opens up that have never been possible before because of traditional finance. So I really applaud your perseverance in finding solutions to problems that were not solvable before, but they are because of this technology.
A lot of failure, trial and error.
Well, that's how you learn, and all of the points that you both mentioned, I think, are great pieces of advice for anyone starting a company. I think a lot of that applies both to Bitcoin and outside of Bitcoin, even just as far as the entrepreneurial journey and staying focused on the real problem and, you know, truly learning who your customer is and what you're trying to solve for, right? I mean, some of the basics that sometimes all of us maybe fall into one or two of those traps, though, regardless, right? All that to say, you know, can't thank you enough for the time, you know, Hannah and Tomas. And we're definitely looking forward to, you know, seeing you guys succeed. I have a feeling that Mifiel is going to be around for quite a while, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, in a few months or a year from now, what that snapshot of the promissory note market looks like for Mifiel in Mexico. And, we hope to get you guys back on at a later date as well, if that's of use.
Yeah, of course. And we gave the Blockstream people a dashboard so they could see the rate at which we are issuing the promissory notes. And Adolfo was the man. I go every 2 days to check, and the number, it just keeps increasing and increasing. So he's super happy with that dashboard.
That's great. Where can people follow you in general? I mean, you're a pretty stealth company. So, what are best ways for other people who may be listening can kind of keep track of your progress or get in touch with you?
Yes. That's by design, because we got out of this, like, you go to all the conferences and they're like, well, all the startup founders go to this conference and that conference. Eventually we said, that's a waste of time. We should be building solutions. So that's why we're very, you can't really find that much of us. But if you want to interact with me, I'm active in Twitter. So, and I have conversations there with Bitcoiners and lawyers because of the place that we move in. It's Tomas.Alvarez. Actually, it's Tomas Alvarez and me, Twitter or Santos. You can find me there. And that's where I interact with people. Hannah doesn't use,
I'm not an avid user of social media, but I can be reached on LinkedIn. So if you search Hannah Kim Mifiel, I'll be there, and I'd be happy to answer any messages if anybody's interested. And our website is mifiel.com.
Well, I'm so excited to reconnect with you both after so many years and to see what you're doing now. And just I'm really excited about the future for Mifiel.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
And yeah. Thank you guys for providing this like platform to talk about Bitcoin focused innovations. I think it's definitely something that was needed in the space and that wasn't there. So appreciate it.
Thank you for choosing Mexico as your base. That's also important.
Thanks for listening to the Build with Bitcoin podcast. If you found benefit in what you heard in this episode, we'd truly appreciate it if you would like, share, or leave a comment on whichever platform you're listening, as this helps others find us, which is especially important for a new podcast. And as a reminder, our content is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not to be considered investment advice or recommendation to invest in any company or asset mentioned in the podcast. Build with Bitcoin is a proud affiliate partner of River, a full-service, 100% reserve custody Bitcoin-only financial services company. For your next Bitcoin purchase, use our exclusive link, partner.river.com/buildwithbitcoin. Thank you sincerely for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.